A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Now, if we look at our nations for a moment, we often have the feeling that our nations have been here forever. And of course they haven't. You know, my country really only became an independent nation in 1922. So it's around about 100 years. People in the UK are often surprised to discover that the UK changed its identity dramatically in 1922. It was no longer the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland.
Welcome to Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. This is going to be the last episode of 2023. And with that in mind, I wanted to do something a bit different while everyone's mind is on feasting and getting over Christmas. So this episode is in some ways completely different, but also relevant to the issues we've covered in the podcast in earlier periods. My guest today, Shane O'Mara, is a professor of experimental brain psychology at Trinity College Dublin and the author of numerous books and studies. He also has a brilliant Substack called Brain Pizza, which I can highly recommend. Recently, Shane published a book called Talking Heads, which explains the unexpected link between human conversation, which of course depends on human memory, and nations, countries, the places we all live in. At a time when nationalism is in its most pernicious and dangerous form, understanding that nation states are just a function of human memory, not some inherent feature of Englishness or Russianness or whatever, that feels like an important insight and worth talking about. So that's why it was a real pleasure to be joined by Shane. We had a really fascinating conversation. So before we go to the interview, I just wanted to thank you, the listeners, for supporting this podcast. This is the 20th episode. We've covered a lot of ground. It's the end of 2023, and I very much hope you'll continue to join me in the new year. Shane, welcome.
Thank you, Arthur. Delighted to be with you.
So Shane O'Mara is a professor at Trinity College Dublin. He's joining me today from Dublin, and he is the author of numerous books, but most recently, a book called Talking Heads, The New Science of How Conversation Shapes Our Worlds. And from the outset, what I'd say is that I know a lot of listeners to this podcast expect me to be talking about geopolitics, about global events, and we will be talking about those today, but we're going to start with a little bit of a discussion of cognitive science. So Shane, perhaps you could tell the audience first, what area are you a specialist in? And then maybe describe a little bit of this book and your work.
Thanks, Arthur. My longstanding interest is in understanding the brain systems that are involved in memory. And of course, this is a major topic of interest as our societies age and we start to rely on external memory systems like Google and other things like this. And disorders of memory are very common, much more common than people might think. And we're going to see more of them in the coming years because we have a terribly sad wave of dementia expected as our societies age over the next 20, 30 years. So the good news, I suppose, is that we now know lots about which bits of the brain are involved in memory and the way in which they likely operate. And we have some good hints as to how it might be possible to prevent memory problems or dementia occurring in the first place, but also perhaps even to treat it with the new generation of drugs that are coming along, which I want to emphasize are not very good at the moment. But yeah, it's the first positive signal that we've had in this area, I think, probably since the 1990s.
Yeah. Well, and I have to say, on that point, I'm sure so many listeners will have experiences with a family member. In my case, two very close relatives of mine have dementia. And therefore, I take an interest in the possibility that maybe 30 years from now, the drugs will be working better. But I had a question from the outset, which is, are our memories generally as humans getting worse? Because it seems that we have, particularly with the smartphone era, you hardly have to remember anything anymore. I mean, as a child, I would need to remember 10 phone numbers, all kinds of other useful bits of information, addresses and so on. Whereas now, I don't think I know any phone numbers, really. I probably just about know my wife's number.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I know my wife's number. I don't know my daughter's number. And I certainly don't know anybody else's number. But is there any evidence that our memories are getting worse? The answer is no. What we are doing, I think, very effectively as humans is what we've done all our existence, which we've offloaded tedious tasks onto machines. There's no particular reason that you want to give a piece of your brain over to remembering telephone numbers. It's much easier just to remember where you put them. Right. And that's much more efficient. It's much less energy demanding. And it extends your capacities in ways that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. So I don't know, I must have a couple of hundred telephone numbers in my phone. I'm sure you're the same. Yeah. I don't have to look them up in a notebook. They're there, they're nice and handy, and it's really, really simple and straightforward.
Yeah. And so your book opens with a description of a fascinating medical case, Henry Malaisen. Could you perhaps describe that case and then and what the significance of that has been to sort of medical science?
Yeah, so Henry Malaisen is a really quite astonishing case. Long story short with Henry, he suffered possibly a road traffic accident at around about the age of 9 or 10. Nobody's really clear. The medical records are very poor and the memory of what happened to him within his family was equally poor. But what we do know is that during his teenage years, he started to suffer really very, very severe epileptic attacks, possibly up to 50 or 100 attacks a day. So these were profoundly disabling. And the drugs available at the time were pretty poor. So they were really sedative in their effect. It was clear from some of the work that had been done with Henry that a part of the brain known as the hippocampal formation, which extends from the top of your ear to your temple, appeared to be the place where his epileptic attacks was originating from. So you have two of them, one on either side of your head. And at the time, very little was known about the hippocampal formation. It was thought to have a role in smell, and it was thought to possibly have a role in the control of emotion. And Henry elected to have an operation on this part of the brain, and it was a great success. His epileptic attacks went away. This was really quite something. And of course, this offered the opportunity to Henry to be able to live a normal life. But in the weeks after the operation, it became clear that something was very amiss, that while his epilepsy had gone away, his ability to form what I'm going to call conversationally updatable memories disappeared. And by that, I mean he was unable to remember the events of the last hours and days in his life. He could remember remote things, what happened to him maybe up to the age of 14 or 15. But new memories, the kind of stuff of everyday life, the gossip that we all trade in, the stories we all tell each other, none of that stuck. Nothing ever stuck for him again. And I'm going to read a small quote from Henry because it gives you a sense of what it's like to have amnesia. And what I want to do then is broaden out the conversation if we can to think about the implications and why this is so important. Yeah. So Henry said, every day is alone in itself, whatever enjoyment I've had, whatever sorrow I've had. Right now, I'm wondering, have I done or said anything amiss? You see, at this moment, everything looks clear to me. But what happened just before? That's what worries me. It's like waking from a dream. I just don't remember. And I find those couple of sentences really affecting in yeah. all sorts of ways. Henry clearly knew he had a problem. So it's not as if having amnesia of the type that he had wiped away his self-awareness. Didn't. His IQ actually remained normal from pre to post the operation, and his yeah. short-term memory remained normal. So you could give him a telephone number to remember, and he could repeat it without much trouble, interrupt him, and it was gone. So yeah. nothing stuck. That's really the key point. And what I ask you to do in the book then is to think about what the consequences of having a problem like this are. What yeah. you've done is put yourself in a position where your life will always be in the care of others.
Yeah. I mean, it is, as you say, that where he describes this sort of sense that he may have done something awful half an hour ago and he'd have no way of knowing that there's this kind of blankness to what's going on, you know, in what we all regard as memory. And it when I first started reading it, I started thinking, well, it's just like an elderly person, but it isn't, because even when we meet people with dementia and so on, there's normally you know, some sense of what's been going on. It's a really fascinating case, and it illustrates the importance of conversation. And in a way, that's what your book is about how conversation creates societies. So perhaps you could say a bit about that.
Yeah. So I think the key point, just to kind of reiterate it about Henry, is that you could not update his memory by conversation. So all of the gossip that we would trade, all of the knowledge that we exchange with each other, which we do all the time, it's kind of like this human default where we tell each other stuff about ourselves all of the time. We reveal private information. We talk about public information. We talk about the football match that happened last Saturday or whatever it happens to be. None of that existed for Henry because it was all lost. No new acquaintances ever became old acquaintances for Henry because he would meet them afresh every time. Yeah. So that means that nothing sticks. Gossip, social memories, all of that stuff is lost. But it means further that you can't look after yourself. Yeah. Amnesia implies a life in the care of others, but it means something more. It means that there are no shared realities that will stick between us. We're not able to enter into a conversation together and know that the next time we have that conversation together, what we've said to each other in the past will stick. And that's our basis for moving forward together. Yeah. So the argument I make is that at its core, our memories are social in nature, and they are what enable us to have a collective existence together because of this continual information interchange that yeah. we engage in all the time.
And that's, I'd say that was such a fascinating idea for me, because I suppose, like most people, I think of my memory or anyone else's memory as a completely private sort of, you know, hard drive that only I have access to. And obviously in some ways that's true, that my thoughts are there, but by definition, of course, they're formed by having lived, you know, I haven't been a hermit, and therefore they've been formed by life around others. And I'm just going to read a bit that you've got in the introduction. It says, we humans are naturally motivated to create a shared reality with others based on shared feeling, beliefs and concerns about the world. And you contrast with our two closest cousins sort of in the animal kingdom, chimpanzees, who are extremely violent, and orangutans are very solitary, and we're somewhere in the middle, aren't we?
Yeah, so we occupy this amazing kind of sweet spot. So orangutans really are solitary. They only meet up to hook up. They don't really get engaged. Otherwise, they you know, the nickname for the orangutan is the old man of the forest, and you're lucky if you see one. Whereas yeah. chimps are very cooperative. But yeah. My God, they're very violent. Yeah. We look at chimps in zoos and think these are kind of nice creatures, but they're being fed and they're in constrained circumstances. But chimp skeletons bear bite marks. They bear, they have lots of scratches. They do each other terrible violence. Yeah. And it's estimated, depending on whose study you look at, that they're between 20 and 30 times as violent to each other as are humans.
Wow.
And humans, of course, you know, when we fight, we tend to do it with words. We tend not to do it with fists.
Yeah.
Whereas chimps scratch, bite, punch, tear each other limb from limb. And who's up and who's down? It's kind of like a Klingon society if you watch Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah. So this point about conversation and shared memory is really at the heart in your argument and your research, sort of at the heart of human civilization, basically.
In essence, yes, because if you have a situation where nobody can remember and there's no common theme, no common story that people have collectively, well, then cooperative efforts are impossible. They might at best be fleeting. So, you know, if you do a simple experiment, a thought experiment, imagine trying to create a football team de novo from a group of amnesics like Henry. It will be impossible. Nobody's going to learn anything. Nobody's going to know the drills, nothing. And that's a kind of a very elementary kind of example. You know, if you're trying to do something more complicated, imagine a deliberative assembly where nobody remembers what happened previously. The minutes of the assembly don't stick. Decisions are lost. And nobody is able to enter into this kind of shared reality where everybody knows we agreed X previously. We're moving on to do Y now. And the consequences of X have been such that we have to set it aside. And Y is now our decision. And we kind of overlook how amazing this capacity is because it's so natural to us. And it's only when you contrast what we can do with other species that I think that suddenly becomes the point of departure of interest for us as humans, that we can sit together, we can deliberate together, we decide together, and we bind ourselves to courses of action. But no troop of chimpanzees is ever going to do this. No pride of lions or anything else. It's something that's really unique to we humans.
Yeah. And I think also I was very interested by that where you explore for those fairly small numbers of humans that can't really participate. So, I mean, Henry Malaison's one example of a sort of medical limitation. But there is, of course, I thought it was really fascinating, the idea of how people who are who get sucked into the kind of conspiracy mindset also end up being excluded, because of course they can't really draw on a shared basis of agreed facts, can they?
Yeah, so I think the conspiracy mindset and the kind of way people think together is almost a microcosm of what goes on in society at large.
Yeah.
But what is missing there is that they are not constantly recalibrated by input that they get from others that say, no, you are talking nonsense. Sorry, that's not true. That language you're using is unacceptable, because groups of racists or homophobes or whatever other reviled group you care to choose engage in the same self-reinforcing conversation. And it's only when they try and make contact with reality or contact with other people that they realize that they're in a very, very different position. If I may be slightly controversial for a moment, I often felt during the whole Brexit debate, looking on it from the outside, that Brexiters were very good at having conversations with themselves, but very, very poor at understanding how anybody else would look on the contents of those conversations.
Yes. Yeah, very true. And of course, they classically illustrated in the way that Britain behaved, again, with its European neighbours, notably your country, Ireland, but also, you know, France and elsewhere, that there's a sort of assumption that it was not just the job of British people, but it was the job of everyone in Europe to join in with Brexit, as if somehow, you know, it was all your project as well as theirs.
Yeah, and we were quite happy not to be a part of it.
Yeah. So we we've talked a bit about this idea of kind of shared understanding, shared memory. How does that translate into the concept of nations and basically into what is currently, a world of nation states? So, you know, we can use these terms like the Westphalian world or whatever, but, you know, we live in a world where people understand that there are countries and there are nations and nationalism, national identity. These are all complex concepts. Where does this this work fit in with that?
Yeah, so there's as it would happen, a slightly complicated story here. But at one time, it's clear that there were no borders. When humans made those multiple trips out of Africa 50 yeah. to 150,000 years ago, we did it in multiple waves. We did it on foot. And the only borders that we ever encountered were physical in nature, yes. you know, so they would be river watercourses or whatever. But at some point, people, and of course, one of the key things about doing this is that humans conquered the world together on foot, yep. but they did it through an exercise of imagination that where we are is not great. Over the horizon, it might be a bit better.
Yeah.
But we had to talk about this. We had to imagine this together. So what you have is this continuous and sophisticated application of memory, language, imagination to create these kind of complex ideas that, yes, we're going to gather up all our gear. We're going to move on. It might be dangerous, but it might be better.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, I think, has to be the starting point. Now, if we look at our nations for a moment, we often have the feeling that our nations have been here forever. And of course they haven't. My country really only became an independent nation in 1922.
Yeah.
So it's around about 100 years. People in the UK are often surprised to discover that the UK changed its identity dramatically in 1922. It was no longer the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland.
And Ireland, yeah.
And it was reshaped. And in the last decades, the Czechoslovakia split. With no guns, no violence, no anything, into two nations. And from the estimates that are out there, there are perhaps 20 or 30 new countries have come into existence in the last 30 years, which is, quite something. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to ask yourself, how is this possible? What is it that's going through the minds of people when they're thinking about how a country should be created? And you can see this in documents. Our commonalities in documents is, as far apart as the Federalist Papers in the US, imagining what a nation might be, are the revolutionaries here in this country in the 1880s and 1890s, imagining a future Ireland, and right up to the present day. And the key thing, I think, the late Anglo-Irish political scientist, Benedict Anderson, suggested that At its core, we imagine our communities together. And he gave us this idea of the imagined community. Mm. And the imagined community requires us to be able to talk to each other. It requires us to have an idea together of the extent and boundedness of our nation, that here's our border. That's all. And a border faces two ways, something Brexiters found a bit hard to understand, I think. The core point is that we're able to enter into a shared reality between the individuals that we define as being members of our nation. And we give each other, for whatever reason, a whole variety of kind of benefits and other things from recognize you as being members of that nation. And my key point here really is that without this continuous and really sophisticated application of memory blended with language, blended with imagination, this would not be possible. Mm. And as it happens, the brain system that is involved in memory, the hippocampal formation, is also the same brain system that's involved in imagining the future.
Right.
So memory and imagination are tied in together in a really, really intimate way. And if you think about, for example, the language that I'll take two U.S. presidents as a contrast, Reagan and Trump. Reagan spoke about the future in glorious terms. He will be mourning in America and all of these wonderful phrases. Whereas Trump always spoke about things in restorative terms, a journey back to the past.
Yeah.
It's make America great again. It was great. Whereas the vision Reagan offered was a really positive one of the future. And I think politicians who are good at this whole business of speaking to the people of a nation are very, very good at sliding along this mental timeline. Have you centered in the present, they invoke elements of the past that are relevant to their case, and they ask us to join together to imagine a future together.
Yeah.
And they can only do this because we have brain systems that allow us to do this. And the limit case, of course, is somebody like Henry, who's not able to join in simply because his memory is not updatable. He can access some of the things of the past, but the journey together is impossible simply because he is unable to update his memory, and he's not able to imagine together with other people what might come to be.
Yeah. And this idea of imagined communities, of course, for some people who probably adhere to a fairly conservative viewpoint of what countries are, that they probably would be a bit threatened by it, because they think you're saying they're not real, that imagined is not the same as real. But in a way, you're not making that distinction, are you?
No, not at all. And I don't think anybody should. You know, laws, in a sense, you know, are imagined. Yeah. You know, we sit down in a legislative assembly and we write laws and we bind ourselves to them. The fact that something is intangible does not mean that it's not real. You know, we can't touch this conversation we're having. You see me as a flat 2D representation. Yeah. I see you as a 2D representation. I know the reality is different, that you have a 3D existence.
Yeah.
But the fact that these things are in our imagination doesn't mean that they're not real. We bind ourselves to them. And of course, the proof of that is that people are willing to die for other members of their imagined community. And we're seeing this in many places around the world where conflict arises. We're seeing it in Ukraine at present, where there are two competing visions, one of an imperializing Russia and the other of a nation that is rejecting that imperialization.
Mm. I want to explore more this sense of sort of imagination and group memory as it applies to countries. And I was wondering whether is it different depending on the sort of geography or other elements? Because of course you have, you know, you and I are both from island nations, Britain and Ireland, albeit, you know, in both cases, you know, plurinational and various complicated borders that exist, but ultimately, you know, we're floating in a sea. And I remember someone telling me, it took me to go to live in another island nation in Trinidad before I got this insight that if you live on an island, the border is a separation, because it's a body of water, it's a sea, and, you know, can be dangerous to cross and so on. Whereas if you live in a continental nation, the border is a meeting point, you know, that by definition. And this concept of insularity, which again, it's funny how you can see it in other places and then you don't necessarily recognize it in yourself. I think we saw a lot of insularity in Britain again through the Brexit years. But so is there a difference? Because I sort of think of, you know, there are complicated bits of the frontier between Belgium and the Netherlands, where there are little sort of bubbles of one country inside the other. And it is that then different to what it might be like to be from, I don't know, a remote island in the Indian Ocean, where there's probably not much immigration in it?
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Immigration.
Yeah, just, that's a really interesting question, and one I haven't really thought properly about, I must be honest. So I do discuss the example of the enclaves and counter-enclaves, yes, and counter-counter-enclaves on the Indian Bangladesh border,
right,
where you have, as you say, with Belgium, these little pockets of land, and they can be quite large. You know, yep. I think in the case of India and Bangladesh, you perhaps several hundred thousand people were living in these pockets, where you might have one pocket surrounded by another pocket. I think you see there you have an interesting disjunction, don't you, between being a member of the nation. You might regard yourself as Indian or Bangladeshi, but you're not able to avail yourself of the rights of that nation. So you can't access the kind of paperwork that entitle you to travel. You might not be able to get a passport. You might not have be able to register births. You know, all the kind of things that sit in the background, which, yeah, you know, to go back to the issue of imagination, these are imagined things. You know, somebody, right, had to sit down and say, well, we're going to write down date of birth, place of birth, yeah, all of those kinds of things, and we're going to put it in a register, and, yeah, other people can go and look at that. That's, yeah, a really weird thing to do. You know, we didn't do it 3,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago. It's something that we've done in the modern world. And similarly, this issue with passports, we didn't need passports to wander around the world 10 or 20,000 years ago. They didn't exist. They became something that we've really put a lot of effort into magicking into being in the last years. Now, to think about nations for a moment, I wonder, the best I can do is anecdote. I don't know of any systematic data. Here, I often think we've been spared most of the extremes of politics because we're a little bit remote. We've got a buffer, which is the large island beside us.
Yeah.
And that in turn is separated from the rest of Europe. Now, yeah, if I was stranded in the middle of the Indian Ocean on a little island, with no immigration and no emigration, I guess my knowledge of the outside world would be bounded by what I can get from mass media, and I might have, yeah, no access to that at all, in which case what I might know and what I might think is reasonable is going to be very, very circumscribed, compared to somebody who's made it off the island and realized Manhattan is out there and Sao Paulo, yeah, is out there, and that there are other people living other lives. But again, you know, to sit back a little, the circumscription of an imagination is not the same thing as having no imagination.
Yeah.
And these people will construct realities together. They will sit together. They will make decisions about, well, will we hunt in a particular area? Will we go to fish in another area? Will we farm in another area? How do we mark the passage of important people in our tribe? What rituals will be associated with birth and death and initiation into adulthood and all of those kinds of things. And, yeah, these are all conversation based, you know, they didn't fall out of the sky. People had to sit around and invent them. Again, just to go back to a British example, lots of the ceremony around the opening of Parliament with Black Rod and all of that stuff, that was all invented in the 1880s.
Right.
I saw a piece on the coronation of King Charles where somebody said, nobody really remembered what we were supposed to do because it was so long since the last one. Yeah. It hadn't been written down.
Yeah, indeed.
What people remember is what they see on telly.
and we have this thing of people sort of love to talk about pageantry and a thousand-year-old ceremony and so on. But if you read some of the accounts of coronations of earlier kings and queens of Britain and earlier England, were completely chaotic. And, the idea that these are these kind of sort of set in a glorious historic, sort of like a beautiful costume drama. I think that they a lot of them would have been kind of slightly hilariously badly organized and look chaotic.
If I might just make a quick point there, you've said something very important, which is worth mentioning as well. A key point regarding the imagination or the imagining of a nation into being is this idea that it's a quote antique. That it has a history and that it's a history that goes back a very long way. And of course, that history is often imagined.
Yes.
It's not a history that we can verify with respect to the history books or to journals from the time or whatever. It's the kind of common understanding that we come to have.
Yes.
And again, how do we come to have that? We come to have it because we talk together. We listen to the radio. We are given bits of information from here, there, and everywhere. And we use group conversation then to calibrate what we think is true of our world.
Yeah. And of course, another great example in the English context, and this is England, is specifically we talk about Magna Carta. And for certain sorts of people, that's an important milestone on the journey to individual rights and democracy and so on, but most historians of that era would say, well, it's not a simple one-way street that begins with 1215. I wanted to talk a bit about migration because it's one of the central political questions of the modern era. It doesn't matter which country you're in, it's significant and important. And of course, this idea of shared memory. If you are a new person in a country, you may have had some access, maybe you've read some books or watched some TV shows or whatever, but fundamentally you don't have that reservoir of shared memories. Is it simply that people have to sort of arrive and catch up in order to feel as though they belong, or is there something more complex about how a new person in a society can kind of feel that they're accepted?
Yeah, so I think countries differ dramatically in terms of how collectively as countries they approach this. The US example, of course, has been very successful. A country that didn't exist 250 years ago now has 700 languages spoken in New York. The line about being a hyphenated American, you're Irish American or you're German American or whatever it happens to be, has been a really very clever way of dealing with difference. You had these astonishing numbers of people pouring principally out of Europe, but also to a lesser extent out of China in the 1800s to the West Coast. But fleeing oppression and difficulty and other things in their homelands, and they go to a new place and they can become American, but it's okay to be Irish American, it's okay to be Anglo American or whatever it happens to be. And what you see very quickly, and there's something that's not really, I think, very well understood by people, is just how quickly people acculturate. So I'll give you a very, very simple example. If I went to live in the UK, I would probably, and I did live in the UK, so I retained my Irish accent when I was there. But if my wife and I had had our daughter over there, she would initially have learned to speak with our accent.
Yeah.
And then she would have acquired the accent of her colleagues in school and her peers in school. Very, very quickly, what people know is determined by the peer group that they are part of. And for children, the marker of accent is a very quick and easy one. They stop speaking in the home accent. They might, in some cases, there are some linguistic studies showing that they will adopt the accent when they go home again, but it's gone when they go to school. They have this kind of bistable state where their accents are concerned. So addressing the kind of larger question, you know, France takes a view that you are French and you, de l'état, c'est moi, kind of view, and that everybody's French and it doesn't matter what your origin is, that you must become French. In Ireland, we've gone from a position where we had 0 or 1% of the population was immigrant to now about 18% or 20% in about 20 years. And generally, the incident in Dublin a few weeks ago, it's been entirely friction free. But there's been this kind of idea that people are expected to become, quote, new Irish, and their children will get involved in the Gaelic Athletic Association or Irish dancing or I don't know, whatever. Yeah. That there's a kind of a blending that's expected. And that has worked, I think, pretty well. And we have citizenship ceremonies for people. But I think countries haven't really negotiated this are very quick to forget their memories of how their own countries came into being. You know, these islands weren't populated 12 or 14,000 years ago. I think the earliest presence on this island, Ireland I'm talking about, is dated to about 10,000 years ago in Kinsale in County Cork. I'm sure England must be somewhat similar, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe 12,000 years ago. And those people had no sense of what a nation was. Yeah. What there was a fertile island to go and live on. Maybe get away from that asshole down the street who keeps stealing your wheat or whatever it happened to be. So I think people being willing to move, people wanting to move is natural. It's part of what makes us human. This is how we've occupied the whole of the planet. Tensions clearly arise. But, you know, I think part of the problem, at least the data that I'm aware of, show that you get tensions where public services have been run down and there hasn't been adequate housing. Yeah. And a scapegoat is looked for. And that we have a particular problem because the population has risen so fast. It's gone up by about 100,000 a year for quite a while. So we started out, you know, 3 million a few years ago. We're 5.2 or 5.3 now, and we should be much higher. And our government simply hasn't built
fast enough houses. Yeah,
it's that simple.
Yeah. And when you dig into the anxieties that people feel about migration, it is normally ends up being a discussion about housing, getting appointments at doctors, surgeries, and you know, schooling. There are some people who hate people who have a different skin color, but there aren't that many of those people, are there? You know, that's quite an unusual thing to end up feeling.
Yeah. But again, these are problems that we impose on ourselves.
Yes.
And these are problems that we can solve ourselves. Right. They're not a given of the natural world, like the water courses through our towns and cities or whatever. Yeah. And we can divert those too.
Yeah.
You know, we can add flood defenses against them. You know, it's a question of our being willing to create a shared reality together.
Yes.
A new shared reality together.
Yeah. I wanted to talk perhaps finally about a little bit about nations that end, and there's been not particularly well known about, but in the last couple of months, there has been an example of this. So Nagorno-Karabakh, which was a part of Azerbaijan, but populated by Armenians, there was not a recognized nation, but certainly a nation. It had a flag, it had a capital city, it had a government. It was called Artsakh. and it was the Armenian enclave in Azerbaijan, and that ceased to exist. The government fled, almost all of the population fled to Armenia, and so that's a thing that was once there that it isn't there now. And then I suppose another case study that is sort of grimly inevitable is, as a result of climate change, some island nations, very low-lying island nations, the Marshall Islands, some of the others, will cease to be at some point later in this century. So is there something, because of course it's not unique in history that nations have ceased to be. There are sort of kingdoms in Central Europe that don't exist anymore. Is there something about how sort of communities deal with that kind of loss?
So I don't think we have a very good understanding of what's going on there. But yeah. I think that, you know, the kind of core part of this has to be that the shared conversation that sustains a nation is gone.
Yes.
And it's broken up in some sense, and that the kind of shared commitment that we have to each other and to our future together is lost. And that's because a supervening vision has come along. That supervening vision has, of course, been taken on and owned and become part of the conversation of a group that may identify itself in particular ways. It might be, you know, they wear particular clothes, or they worship on a Saturday, not on a Sunday, or yeah. Who knows? It doesn't really matter. But the key point is that people are able to define an in-group and an out-group.
Yeah.
And it may well be the case that the out-group is a smaller group that has much less power, and they're not allowed into that shared conversation. You know, and a generous way of looking upon these things, of course, is to say, well, we're all humans together, and we have to share this space together. But yeah. Very often conflict arises over resourcing, over yes. over issues to do with power, and often memories of things that may or may not have happened, but that fester in various ways, and that can be weaponized by clever politicians. And, you know, we saw that in Eastern Europe in the late 1990s. Again, and of course, we have continuing unresolved issues there 30 or so years on.
Yeah, and arguably, similarly, perhaps in Israel-Palestine, where there is, there's a reservoir of resentments and injustices for both sides to draw on, and therefore it clouds the present day considerably, doesn't it?
Yeah, but you see, again, you know, think again about the shared area we have on this island between the UK and Ireland. Yeah. With generosity, it was possible for the communities there to come together. Now, what's happening at the moment is not good, but compared to what happened before, it's much, much better. And this willing into being of new institutions, of new things that people commit themselves to, and this willingness to allow people to have a kind of the phrase was used at the time, a variable geometry of connectedness, so that you could be British, you could be Irish, you could be both, yeah. you could be Northern Irish. That diffused much of the tension there, but of course it took a long time to get to that point. There was 30 years of terrible violence before then, and it's been, you know, it's been a little bit unstable. There's an equilibrium though that is better than the one that obtained before.
Yeah, definitely. And interesting, I wanted to perhaps finally that reference to the complexity of British, UK, Irish relations draws us onto another related point, which is the way that nationality as a useful tool of a status has become very desirable. And the classic case study is the Irish passport, which for decades, I imagine the average British person wasn't particularly interested in what an Irish passport was. And now just about everyone I know is researching whether they have an Irish grandparent, or, you know, whether they can avail themselves of being obviously a European citizen. It's fascinating because, and I'm sure you've had cases, you'll know of people like this. I know of people who have a grandparent born on the island of Ireland because one of their ancestors was a British soldier, arguably part of a sort of colonial oppressive force, but that still entitles them to be a citizen of your country and therefore a citizen of the European Union, where somebody else, you know, whose grandparents were not involved with that thing, don't have that. So that's one case study. And then the other sort of related thing is that, you know, there are certain countries now that will sell you nationality.
Yeah, Belize.
Yeah. And you know, it's often small islands in the Caribbean, and it could be useful for people with slightly controversial backgrounds to sort of launder their own story. So are these things sort of breaking down what it is to be a citizen, because it's more about a series of sort of privileges that go with that rather than what you describe, which is sort of part of human evolution?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point. So I think, you know, some people will have an instrumental relationship with a passport. They don't give a toss. Yeah. They literally are citizens of nowhere, to use your former prime minister's. Well, they are citizens of somewhere. They just don't care where.
They don't care.
Yeah. They don't care. Now, the issue with the Irish passport is kind of interesting because I think the general view among Irish people is that this nation has had a really unpleasant past. Irish people ended up all over the world, and we like to feel connected with them, the 70 million or so that claim Irish descent. And there's relatively little issue, I think, with people in the UK. We kind of welcome it. In a way, you know, it's nice to see people wanting to establish I believe John Le Carré, for example, became
in the last few weeks of his
life. It's fun for us. Again, I believe Margaret Thatcher had a grandmother who was Irish. So it's fun for us to discover these kind of relations. And actually, in the UK case, I understand that if you were born in Ireland before 1948, you are entitled to a UK passport.
Oh, so yes, it goes both ways.
Yes, yeah. Because of the Ireland Act, which finally recognised that we might not be foreign, but we were separate.
Yeah, I didn't know that side of it. I don't want to talk down the country, which is a thing that people say. But I wonder whether how many people are, if they already have Irish citizenship, there isn't much need to have a British passport, because of course you've got the common travel area anyway.
We have the common travel.
Yes. it's a fascinating case study, of course, because you have undoubtedly, centuries of Britain dominating Ireland, colonizing Ireland, and in the culture in England in particular, belittling Irish people in all manner of ways. And now there's been a considerable change. One, that the passport has become a desirable asset. I wish I had an Irish grandparent. I don't, sadly. But also the irony of the post-Brexit arrangements, where now people like Rees Mogg have to set up their hedge funds in Dublin because they need that access to the EU market. So that's in terms of a collective memory, it must be very transformative for the Irish people to see this evolution of status vis-a-vis the former colonial power.
Yeah, I think, I like to be data driven in what I say. So I don't really know if there've been any behavior and attitudes kind of surveys on this. But my sense is that people are interested and amused by it.
Yeah, right. Well, that's very, very diplomatically put. Well, Shane, your book is really fascinating. And as this conversation, I hope, has borne out. I guess it, my last question is about AI and tech, because memories created by humans interacting, you know, are the basis of all human society everywhere. But we're just sort of on the verge of a world where people can interact with non-human bots and IT and so on. Do you think that will then change the sort of fundamental nature of human society?
I don't know is the honest answer. You know, so if we think of a few cases that are worth kind of focusing on, Elon Musk has made a big noise about Neuralink, you know, pretending that this technology that they're using is one that's new, and of course it's not. Goes back to the 1940s, this idea that humans and AI will merge is nonsense, and his technology will not allow you to do that.
Right.
AI needs all the data in the world for it to work.
Yes.
You know, so
literally,
literally, it needs every bit of data. Humans don't.
No.
The if I might use a technical term, the neurodynamics of the brain are such that the brain needs almost no input to generate its output. So you and I have learned to speak, you know, in our early years of life. We might only have been exposed to a few hundred thousand words, and somehow we can magic a complete grammar out of it. We can end up creating memories together. We can interact together across the water as we are doing with almost no data at all, because our brain engages in this thing called a default mode activity, where it's constantly talking to itself. And it's constantly testing ideas and hypotheses against what's going on in the outside world. Now, it might be something as simple as, what's the weight of this pen that I'm picking up? Am I going to be thirsty in 5 minutes and I'm going to need a drop of water? Or what it is that you're going to say in anticipation, or to the whatever conclusion I come to at the end of this sentence. You know, there's all of that kind of thing going on. So our brains and AI are really very, very different. We've been sculpted by years of evolution. We've been selected in particular ways. And I might be proven wrong, but I'm not one of these AI doomsters. I don't think that the singularity is coming. Skynet isn't coming to kill us. It'll just be another tool that... we'll get used to, in the same way we got used to wheeled vehicles and calculators and literacy and this amazing technology, the book.
Yes.
You know, you can go to the library here and pull books that are 500 years off the shelf, and you can read them. You can't do that with a CD from 1990.
No, good point. Yeah. Well, that's a perfect point to conclude. Well, this particular example of amazing technology, Shane O'Mara's book, Talking Heads, The New Science of How Conversation Shapes Our Worlds, highly recommended. Thank you for talking to me today.
And thank you, Arthur. That was great. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines. Don't forget to subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. And if you've enjoyed it, please give us a positive review from wherever you get your podcasts. Behind the Lines is produced by me, Arthur Snell, and the music is by Matty Benbrook.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.